Hello, everyone. This is Steve Sykes, and you're listening to the Front Row Network, the podcast network for people who actually like movies. It's October, and that means MonsterCast here at the Front Row. And today we have a very special guest on the podcast. Diane Franklin is an iconic 80s American film actress known for her dark curly hair and her ear for dialects. Beginning her acting career at the age of 10, Diane started with modeling, theater, commercials, and soap opera work. She then won the lead role of the dream girl Karen in cult classic The Last American Virgin, and soon after played the daughter Patricia Montelli in Amityville 2, The Possession. Her breakout film role was the spirited French exchange student Monique Junot from the offbeat comedy Better Off Dead. And her most notable commercial success was playing the medieval princess babe Joanna from the 1980s iconic comedy Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventures. Diane has written two autobiographies, Diane Franklin, The Excellent Adventures of the Last American French Exchange Babe of the 80s, and Diane Franklin, The Excellent Curls of the Last American French Exchange Babe of the 80s. It is my extreme pleasure to welcome to the Front Row Network, Diane Franklin. Hello, Diane.
Hello, bonjour, and cheers to all of you who know me as Princess Elizabeth in Bill and Ted's. Thank you for having me on the show.
Did I give you the wrong princess name?
No, actually, I don't think you mentioned it. You know, I am Princess Elizabeth, and I have to have, if you read that somewhere or something, I have to, actually, that has to be fixed because, well, it's not your fault, because when they actually did Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventures, they got the credits wrong.
Oh.
So what happened was, on the credits, it says I'm Princess Joanna, but the reason why I'm Princess Elizabeth is because they did do the sequels, and they kept the same characters, although they didn't hire the same actresses, but because they did, the credit got was always wrong, so I was always Princess Elizabeth, but it's not your fault, it's someone who did the credits.
Darn those credits writers, oh my goodness.
Double check, that's why you gotta double check, right? Watch now, the film, right? Okay.
The very first thing I have to ask you is the first question that we always ask guests on their first appearance on a Front Row podcast. So, Diane Franklin, what is your favorite movie of all time?
Oh, as if that's an easy question. Okay. I'm going to have to say, now that's just not fair. Okay. Because now all these movies are coming to mind. But I'm just going to go with the first one that came to mind because it was the most influential to me in my career. But there's so many others. Okay, I have to say Sophie's Choice. Mm. And for those of you who don't know it, it was one of the first films that Meryl Streep was in. And although everyone says, oh, Meryl Streep's a great actress, you know, I think what it is it's when you watch someone and you totally believe their character and you believe that that's who they are, that's kind of when you know that that's a great actor. You just believe it. And she played I forgot the country she was from, but she did a dialect, Polish, I think. Mm-hmm. And her dialect was so incredible, and her emotion and her vulnerability. And the combination of all those things is what we look at and we go, oh my God, that's amazing acting. So what happened was I watched her at a young age. And I think also, you know, it's funny, like, I think watching films at a young age is the thing that when, you know, movies hit you. So I probably was like, 12 or I don't know, like I was really young. And when I heard her speak, that's when I said, ooh, I want to be an actress like her. I want to do the dialects. So that I think is what got me to be in love with, you know, doing this French accent or a German accent or an English, you know, dialect or something. So I think, you know, she influenced me as an actress, so I have to say Sophie's Choice. And I mean, the film was incredible, but I just was wrapped up in that film.
Well, that's great. That is excellent. You mentioned a little bit about Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which has turned into kind of a cultural phenomenon. Tell me about your experience working on that.
Okay, so we did that in 1987. And it was the height of, you know, the 80s. And when I went in, I actually thought I was going to audition for I thought I was going to audition for Joan of Arc, because I played a French girl in Better Off Dead. So I thought, oh, well, I'm going to, you know, I'd love to play the French girl in this. But when I realized later, I did after I auditioned, she has no dialogue. Joan of Arc has no dialogue. So, but when I was there, they asked me if I could do an English accent. And I said, of course I can do an English accent. And they said, well, would you, you know, like to play a princess? And I was like, well, oh, sure. You know, I don't know much about what you're talking about, but of course. And so they wound up hire me as one of the princesses. And that film was just such a fun film to do. I mean, working with Bill and Ted, how can it not be, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, there's so much, they're so fun and they were so cute, and it was just great energy.
Fantastic. I want to go back a little bit to the beginnings of your career. First of all, how did you get into show business?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I think it was, I got into it because I just, from a very young age, knew what I wanted to do, and I just stayed on it with my parents. I just stayed on them. I mean, I showed my interest. You know, I took singing lessons and dancing lessons, and I participated in plays. And, you know, I think what it is, if you want to be a performer, an actor, or a singer, you just have to keep doing it. And then from doing it, people can tell that that's, you know, that's the direction you're going to go. So my parents really, they were German immigrants and Austrians, they took places. They were like, what do we do with this child? I don't know what to do with this. And I'm like, I want to be an actress on TV, because I was actually the first born. I'm the first one born in this country. Like, my parents were born in Germany and Austria. So I had this sort of immigrant mentality, which was like, I'm in America and I want to make things happen. You know, we're a free country and your dreams can come true. And I mean, even at a young age, I got that. So what happened was I just kept on them. And then eventually when I was 10 years old, they said, and it sounds like I was like, you know, 25, but I was bothering them from like age 4 to 10. I knew at 4 years old that I wanted to be an actress. And they said, okay, you know, they found an agent. I mean, through trials and tribulations of going through the, you know, meeting the wrong people, we met the right people. And eventually I started with a modeling agent. And more detail on this is in my book, but it's, I started with that and I did commercials and theater and soap opera and voiceovers until I got my first film.
Okay.
At 19.
Excellent. Now, 1982 was a big year for you. You were featured in two movies that year, The Last American Virgin and Amityville 2, The Possession. How did those roles come about?
Well, I'll tell you what was fascinating to me is I never, for the longest time, I didn't even realize it, because I did, actually, Virgin, I did sort of in like 1980, we shot it in 1981. But it didn't come out till 82. And then Amityville, we shot in 82, but it came out in 82. So it was very surprising to me. I had no work out at all. But then all of a sudden I was on the scene and I was this new person. So that was an unusual like experience for me, because I went from being like nobody knew to suddenly like, you know, word of mouth, like Diane Franklin, you know, which was, you know, in the entertainment business, people started to know who I was. But I started out, Virgin happened by a complete accident, which I wrote my book about, my second book about, and that was basically, so the details are there, but I was going to college at the time. I went to NYU, and the day of my chemistry exam, I booked out with my agent. I said, I'm not going on an audition. Nope, I got my exams. It's more important. I was majoring in biochemistry, and I'm like, that's my life. I mean, I'm going to act too, but I'm going to go to school for science. And then what wound up happening was I looked at that chemistry exam, and I went, I have a better chance of getting a lead in a feature film than I do this movie. So this movie audition that I was told, I actually raced uptown to meet the director and producers. But what happened was, because I decided I wasn't going to go for an audition, I never, I let my hair go curly, and I have really, really tight curly hair. So this was not fashionable in the 70s, and I had to straighten it every day. And anybody who has curly hair understands it was not considered attractive in the 70s. It was not, it was bushy, it was frizzy. You were always trying to hide it. Your hair was out of control. And I'm serious, like back east, your hair just, there was nothing you could do. And there was no product for it. But I got hired in that film, and that Last American Virgin was the first film that made a curly haired girl be the dream girl. And so dark curly hair, that ethnic beauty, was suddenly something that they understood. And it was, they were European, Boaz Davidson is an Israeli director and the producers were Israeli. So I think they looked at the hair and the, my look and they went, you know, that's beautiful. So to me, I remember distinctly, it was shocking that I was given this opportunity. It was a lucky break, but it was also a cultural change, because once Virgin was out, and I remember this, I wrote, that's what I wrote about in my book, and I wrote, I remember even writing it at the time in my journals, that it kickstarted all of a sudden, all the girls who had been straightening their hair suddenly let their hair go natural. So Sarah Jessica Parker, Julia Roberts, the girl who's in Flashdance,
Jennifer Beals.
Yeah, Jennifer Grey. So all of a sudden, all this ethnicity was okay in America. Like it was just all right. So it was in fact beautiful or cool. So, and people got their hair permed and I was like, whoa, that is, I mean, I never thought I'd see the day that was gonna happen. So it just goes to show that if you have something, if you're an actor, performer, and you have something special and unique, and right now that's really what people are hiring, is you being authentic to you, what makes you special. And I just got to say, I really think it started with Last American Virgin, because it was a film that was under the radar, and people, everybody watched it, but people didn't admit they watched it. And guys watched it, and what happened was then they started getting a crush on the curly haired dark ethnic girls, and then that became the thing that, you know, sort of got more of those films, you know, accepted. So it's very interesting. I've really thought a lot about how culture is affected by films, and sometimes we really don't know, but all of a sudden, you know, films mimic life and life mimic film, you know.
That's fantastic. Yeah. And in reading about your life, I saw more than one instance where it was mentioned that you kind of were a pioneer in the curly haired babe phenomenon. So
yes.
Just another thing to put on your resume there. So,
well, it didn't hit until the 80s. I know that Amy Irving had curly hair in Carrie, but she was beautiful, but she was still the bad girl, or she wasn't, mm-hmm. she wasn't the lead, right. You know, the desirable. And it wasn't until the 80s where I think when America's ready for it, you know, you can be Bibi and you're saying, why can't I get discovered? Why can't something happen? You may be ready, but the world might not be ready. Mm. So take that in, actors.
Fantastic. <Don't give up. laughs> Yeah. So between Virgin and Amityville 2, you now find yourself an emerging actress. You've made a teen sex / romantic comedy and a horror movie. And then in 1985 comes your biggest role to date in Better Off Dead, with John Cusack. Tell me a little bit about that experience.
Oh, this, I have to tell you, is fantastic. I love this film. it is, I was just so fortunate that Savage Steve Holland wanted me to be in that film, because he actually saw me in Last American Virgin and he wanted me to be, actually I auditioned for Beth. But when I came in and I saw there was the French girl, I just thought they wanted me I had just actually played a French girl in another film. And I thought, oh, well, I'd want to do this. So when I started, I took like this in the audition and they were like, they were blown away. I think it sort of just goes to show that when you go and do something and you want it, but you don't just say you want it. You take that extra step, you know, and I think that's what happened with that film. And I have to say that the character of Monique, if you haven't seen the film, the role I played was such a great role model for girls, and not a lot of, it was the first time you really saw it was a girl, a character that she's it's a very funny story, but she's tormented by the next door neighbor and she's coming to the country and she's very smart, but she's also very capable, but she's also very feminine. And I think it was kind of fascinating that they made it into a French girl as opposed to an American girl who could do all those things. You know, yeah. It's like, well, you could have made an American girl do that, but all right, fine. It'll be French. And then everybody will want to be French. But it was just a great and very funny film. And by the way, you really nailed it with this film, because I actually am writing a book about Better Off Dead right now. And the film is going to, I've gotten interviews from people in it. And I wrote my books and I thought, I really want to pay tribute to it. So if everyone stays in touch with me, you know, you'll find out when it's coming out, but next year it'll be coming out.
Fantastic. Yeah, definitely look for that. So you co-starred with John Cusack in that film, and he, when I looked at the timelines of your careers, you were kind of at similar points in your careers then, both emerging actors. What was it like working with him at that moment?
All right, I'm going to tell you, working at John at that time, I was so lucky to work with him because he was young. He was open and upbeat and fun. And we had a blast working on that film. And even though I know that John wanted to, I mean, he's a very sweet and deep and dear person. He's very, he is very thoughtful, but he's also wickedly funny. I mean, he is such a funny guy, but very understated. We had a great time working together, but the only thing was, I think after Better Off Dead, he just didn't want to be seen as the goofy guy, you know? And so people get the wrong impression from him. You know, they think that he's, you know, doesn't have a sense of humor. He's like very straight. He wanted to be seen in a different light than Better Off Dead. But all I can tell you is during the filming of it, we had a blast. He was goofy and fun and just adorable. And endearing, you know, we had such a great time. And he and Curtis Armstrong had a wonderful relationship on set. I mean, we all did. We all got together at the end of the evening after we worked and hung out. And like when we went to the ski resort afterwards, you know, we'd get in the lobby in front of the fireplace and like tell stories. And so it was great. It was a wonderful experience. And I think you see that in the film when you watch it.
Right.
And one more thing, Savage Steve Holland, by the way, was 24 when we did the film. So he was young. I mean, he was one of us. So usually when you do a film, if the director's so much older, you know, the director goes away and the cast kind of hangs. But the director was all our age, you know, 20s, early 20s. And so we all just got along and hung. It was a very special experience.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Now, at that point, after that movie came out, you kind of had, you were at a fork to where you'd done some horror and you'd done some teen young adult comedy work. And your career then kind of takes a turn more towards the horror side of things. You have credits like Freddy's Nightmares, Terror Vision, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, the ABC TV movie Deadly Lessons. What intrigues you about working in the horror genre?
Well, what I think is fascinating to me is there's the horror genre back then was kind of more one, it was lumped together. And so you did horror, and horror was also not looked at as something good. It was like, well, you know, you do horror films. And it wasn't seen, and also this had to do with obviously the critics being in control of films. Really, the critics could make or break a film, but in the 80s, their job was basically you had like your $5 and you're saying, where am I going to spend it? And they couldn't say, you know, oh, well, go see this horror film or go see this comedy. They're going to say, go see Officer and a Gentleman or go see, you know, Amadeus. So for them, like their ratings It was difficult, I think, because I don't think that they could, maybe they would have normally wanted to watch movies like that, but they couldn't even say that. It was more like their, maybe the studios needed them to, you know, push those films. So whatever, that was the 80s. But today, everything is much more boutique and fun. So for me, as an example, like horror could be a horror parody, or it could be a gory horror, or it could be a thriller horror, or you might like, you know, very, you know, with ghosts, or you like it with vampires. So we become much more specialized. And the thing, the reason why I, as an actress, wanted to do horror, and by the way, it's very interesting. When I did Amityville 2, The Possession, I said, you know, you got to do your bucket list horror film to say you're an actress. If you don't do a horror film, you can't be an actress. Do you know what I mean? Like, almost like the bucket list of an actor. Well, got my that under my belt, you know? And it's certainly fun to do. It's a great role, you know, great genre to play. But there's also drama in it. And, you know, if you look at something, let's say a murder mystery, the person who's in murder mystery is always... They're looking for clues, but there's the, you know, even on, even if you watch like a CSI or something, there's murder, you know, there's death. So in a way that horror and drama are very similar, you know, they have a similar feel. And so I've always liked horror because I like surprises. And I like when you watch something and you get surprised. And I was just reading recently about this, how horror is, horror goes up in our society when things are unstable, okay? So today, a lot of people like horror and science fiction because the world is very unstable. And what horror does is it gets you to practice in your mind how you would deal with something if it happened to you. But because it's make-believe, you feel relaxed to be scared and it's okay because you know it deep down it's make-believe, but it's sort of like a practice emotionally. So I think people look at horror and they go, ugh, I don't want to watch that. And I understand there's levels of it, but to cross it off completely, you're missing out on a very valuable part of the human existence, you know, who we are and how we react to things. So,
yeah, I like the idea. I like the idea of vicariously watching a horror movie and kind of training your brain for dealing with those circumstances. So, That's really cool. And you're still active, quite active in the horror genre. 2 years ago, you revisited the Amityville story by starring as Louise DeFeo in The Amityville Murders, which is currently showing on Hulu, Sling, and Stars. I just got to watch this in the last couple of days, and man, it's a great movie. It's a really good, scary movie.
Thank you. Oh my goodness. I was so happy to do it. It was a magical surprise as an actor because, you know, I played Patricia Montelli in Amityville 2. I played the daughter in this story. And for those of you who don't know, Amityville Murders is basically the same story, but now I'm playing the mother. Mm-hmm. So now there's no other actress who's ever played the daughter and the mother in the same story. I keep wondering when is there going to be some kind of a film where they cut pieces where I'm talking to myself, you know, mm-hmm. like as a mother and a daughter, you know, so, but the film is, what I loved about Amityville Murders is that was based on the true story of what happened with Ronnie DeFeo. And so I actually got to play a real person who experienced, Louise DeFeo obviously was a real woman who experienced the pain and horror. And obviously I do not condone violence. In fact, I'm really kind of not a big violent person. I mean, certainly, and you know, I don't like the whole idea of violence in films necessarily, but I do think that they, you know, out of the respect for them, you know, that you don't forget what happened. When I got this part, I was like, I am going to play this as in such respect to Louise DeFeo. Like if she was to look back and go, oh my gosh, thank you for expressing all the feelings that I was going through during a time with my family. And to be able to express it in a way that makes people think and feel. Because if you sometimes, you know, look, I mean, people who go through experiences, maybe they're not necessarily, you know, what you want them to be or think they should be, but an actor can bring the best part of their character, create empathy for them. So I think that film really brings a lot of empathy into, like, the audience. Did you feel like when you watched it, you as an audience member felt like you understood the family dynamics more or could identify with it?
Absolutely. That was one of the things that distinguished itself to me was we got to get a lot more into the relationships in the family and dreams that maybe had been deferred and were lurking under the surface. And it was as much of a family, a dysfunctional family drama as it was a horror movie. And that's what amps up the energy to the actual horror parts of it.
Absolutely. And by the way, I have to tell you, the director, Daniel Ferens, he actually hired me for another project. And this is a secret project. I'm not telling to tell you what it's about because I'm sworn to secrecy, but it's going to be a big project. And it's got some great surprises. I'm so excited for this film to come out. It's going to come out next year. But so if you liked Amityville, The Murders, and this film will knock you out. It will knock you out. It's going to be amazing. So, but I'm so grateful. Daniel was a fan. Daniel Ferens, the director, writer, was a fan of me in Amityville 2, The Possession. He was a kid. He was 12 years old watching Amityville 2, as everyone did. I was like, where are your parents? Everyone's sneaking down at midnight in the 80s watching like this R-rated movie. Mm-hmm. Then suddenly everyone's like, I watched that. I'm pretty cool. I've passed the horror test. But he loved that film so much, he never forgot about it. So when he became an adult, that's when he contacted me and said, I would like to offer you the part of Louise DeFeo. And I burst into tears, literally, when I found out. So
that's so neat. In the Amityville Murders, Chelsea Ricketts plays the daughter character, basically the same character that you were in Amityville 2. How was that? Did you share any stories with her about the prior movie or the character?
Well, it was interesting. She actually had seen the film because I went to her and I said, do you want to have is there any information you want or anything? And I actually brought her some photos from shooting the film, you know, and kind of like as a gift to her, you know, because I knew like this, you know, that's a big thing to have the actress that you're working with, you know, now she played you and you get nervous as an actress, like, am I going to do a good job or, you know, is this going to be the same? But she had such maturity and she was such a pro and she knew what she was going to do. And she did ask me some things like to help her with a little bit. But she was a lovely actress to work with. She did a great job. And the thing for me was there were certain shots that Dan did that were exactly like Amityville 2, The Possession. Mm-hmm. And that took me back. I mean, that shot of her on the stairs, I looked at, Chelsea and I was just blown away. I was like, oh my gosh, that's what people saw in me when I was on the stairs. And I felt so bad for her. Like even at the end, I felt so bad. I was crying because she did such a lovely job in the film. So,
and the two of you had wonderful chemistry, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. As did, you know, I mean, Amityville, The Possession, I had the wonderful chemistry with my mom or Tanya Alda. And so I wanted to pass that down to the next generation. And by the way, we wanted to get Ritanya into the film. It was shot, they did it so quick, but mm-hmm. but I actually was in her corner saying, let's bring her in. And the producers, they couldn't get her to, you know, get it happening. And everybody, they do their best, but I'm the actress. I couldn't do more than I did. But was great that I could bring that relationship from the first film into this. And then Burt Young.
Just going to mention. So nice to see him.
Oh my gosh, he played my dad in the first film. Well, now he still plays my dad in the second film. But that moment when we see each other is all the love.
Yes, absolutely. And that just showed right through. No. Fantastic. Now, I know that you mentioned your super secret project, and I won't badger you any further on that. I have a couple more titles here that looks like you have projects on the horizon. I've got a film by the name of Waking Nightmare. Can you tell me about that?
Oh, yes. So Waking Nightmare, I have been waiting for this film to come out for years. We did it in 2017. And the role I play in this film, you have never seen me play this kind of person. And that's another, that is one of another reason why I'm doing more horror things, because I want to stretch myself in characters that you wouldn't necessarily, you know, see me in. Although I mean, it's not like I wouldn't do comedy. I also have a comedy coming out as well. But the thing about it is that for older women, roles are just not there in a lot of films. But in horror, there seems to be more, there's an embellishment. I don't know, maybe that's not the right word, but it's, there's more of exploration of the older actress. And so like Lynn Shay, for instance, you know, like she's just gotten some, she has just a great, she has her moments. She has her, she's been given great roles. And so that is what the goal of an actress my age is, that I want to just play great characters and keep it going, you know, just sort of, you know, explore. I mean, like I'd love to do sci-fi. I'd love to do like some kind of Star Trek, you know, being captain and like, you know, on the ship, or some alien, you know, person, or just, I mean, that's a place that I haven't gone to and explored yet, but I would love to. So the Star Wars and the, or even action. I did another film. It was an action film, but I didn't do the action in the film, but I would love to do an action film. So there's still things on my bucket list that I'm interested in, but Waking Nightmare should come out next year. The director promised me, but whatever. But you will see me as a character. I play a mom who has a daughter who she's played by Shelley Regner, who was in Pitch Perfect. And Shelley Regner, she's one of the Bellas, so she's got a phenomenal voice. She actually is in a group called the Acapellas, I think, or for Disney. They like do some kind of singing things, and she's a lovely actress. We had some great chemistry together, and she plays a girl who actually commits murders in her sleep.
Oh.
Myself and then the gentleman who plays my husband is Jamison Newlander. He was in The Lost Boys. Mm-hmm. And so we have great chemistry. He was a fun actor to work with, and so we played, and then she came, and so it's a great movie. Like the director said, oh my gosh, Diane, people are going to be really shocked when they see you.
That's so great.
Okay, cool.
Well, so, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's exciting.
And I see another movie that looks like Clay Zombies.
Oh, my God. Now, right. Okay. So that is my bucket list film. This young director contacted me. And, you know, I've been sent scripts. There are scripts I absolutely do not do. I cannot do. It's like I don't take everything. When I heard that this young man had a script called Clay Zombies, I was like, I have to be in this film. I need to be in a zombie film. It's my bucket list of films. I must be in a zombie film. So and he is very excited. He thinks it's going to come out maybe before the end of the year. So I don't know. So that is going to be a horror film. It's an indie film. And yes, there are clay zombies. And my character, I play this DJ. And an 80s DJ. So again, it's a character I've never played before, but you're gonna really like it. You know?
Oh man, I can't wait. Sounds like fun.
Very fun. It's very fun. It's like, to me, like I like movies like The Blob and The Invisible Man. And so this is sort of lends it to itself. It's like, let's have some fun. Let's watch a zombie movie, like have popcorn and hang out. And so.
That sounds like a good time.
I have a good sense of humor. Yeah, good time.
Now, I wanted to ask you a couple questions about when you were growing up. I believe you learned when you were 4 years old that you were deaf in one ear. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. I am actually deaf on my right ear. I always have to check. I keep forgetting. And my parents didn't know. Well, when you're completely deaf, that's an easy way to, you know, the doctor smacks or slaps and, you know, if you don't respond, then they know you can't hear. But when you're deaf on one ear, nobody can tell anything until you are old enough to respond. So basically, it wasn't until I was around 4 years old, because when people would be next to me, if they called me, I wouldn't know what direction to look in. We had a split level house. My mom would call me from upstairs and I would run downstairs to get her. And then that was kind of like, they'd be like, wait, why is she running downstairs? I'm up here. Or if there was a lot of sound on one side of my, on my left side, and someone was literally standing right next to me and talking, you know, saying my name, I wouldn't turn around. I didn't hear them because the sound was being, you know, eaten up by my left ear. So, but I think as an actress, that really helped me because I really had a lot of eye contact and I listened carefully because I couldn't afford to check out. You know, I couldn't afford to just, you know, rely on my hearing. You know, I always had to rely more on visual cues or, I mean, the hearing in my good ear is excellent. It compensates. It just has to do with more direction and balance. I can't ride a bike. Sad. I always wanted to ride a bike. I ride in my dreams. I visualize them riding in my dreams. But because I can't get that balance, that center, that single balance, you know. So I can get on 2 feet. Like I can balance on, you know, like ice skates or something, because I've got balancing, but that one, I always go, right?
Yeah, the reason I brought that up is I've just started a new podcast with the Front Row Network called View from the Back Row. I'm a wheelchair user, so I've been interested in how different characters are with disabilities are portrayed in movies, and how disabled actors or actors with a disability have faced a unique set of challenges in their career. And you kind of already answered this question, but has that impacted your career at all?
You know, I'll tell you something. If it has, I would not have known it. Because I think that sometimes when you have a disability, certainly if a director was talking or someone was talking to me and I wouldn't respond, they wouldn't assume I was deaf. They just assume I wasn't listening, or, you know, and then they might just go, oh, next. So I think what's fascinating is that in the terms of disabilities, you either have, I mean, in my case, and, you know, I was raised at a time where the disabilities, you couldn't say you had a disability. You had to rise above it and find a way out of it. So it was your responsibility to compensate for it. So I think what it also did was, in my personality, it made me very, I'd say to the better. I'm more grateful. I'm more, you know, I'm grateful for getting projects. I'm more like, I'm ready to go. I'm prepared, because I know I can't rely on just, you know, chilling back and like going, oh, whatever, right? So I don't know if you feel this way, but I think to a certain extent, I mean, I know another actress who is blind on one eye, and she never tells anybody because she doesn't want people to, I don't know. I think it's part of the entertainment business where you just don't look at my fault, you know, like, right. Let's look at what I can do, which is very admirable. I mean, honestly, it is. When, you know, you have disability, you go, you know what, don't consider me, don't even look at my disability, look at me, you know, look what I can do. And I think that's really good, but it is also harder on the person with a disability because they have to compensate in a way that maybe a normal person who didn't have that problem would even think about.
You always feel like you have to be on all the time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I can definitely relate to that aspect of it.
Well, bring me on your show, that one too, because it's another place where, you know, a lot of people feel like, oh, in the entertainment business, you have to be perfect. You have to be perfect hair and perfect face and perfect body. And, you know, and I'm telling you, there is not one perfect actor or model that's out there. Everyone is overcoming something that they didn't want you to know. Maybe they have tragedy in their life. Maybe they have, an eating disorder. Maybe they're like, they don't want you to know that they have had a hair lip operation, or they, like, you know, they have acne or mold or whatever. Like, just, you just don't know. So don't compare yourself to people. Just, I always say, don't look at other people's garden and ignore your own. You know, other person's garden, great. Take care of your own garden. Plant your flowers. Do the dirt. Your garden's going to be beautiful. Take care of yourself. Take care of your spirit and your mind and your body. We ignore our bodies a lot of times because it's so overwhelming. But the truth is, if you take it bit by bit and you just say, okay, today's the day I'm just going to be nice to myself and I'm just going to take good care of my health and, you know, do things, it will happen, you know. But if we get critical on yourself, well, you know, it starts with, if you like you, then others will like you. If you don't like you, then how can you expect others to like you, right?
So. It's like you snuck a look at my interview notes because I was going to wrap up our time by mentioning that you had written in one of your autobiographies that your mother told you to, quote, never lose your happiness. And that really struck me. Have you been able to do that? And if so, how?
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, that was one of the most wonderful pieces of advice. I mean, I'm sure a lot of kids or adults even have parents that gave them one piece of advice that they hold on to. You know, my dad gave me something, my mom gave me something. And holding on to your happiness, it means so much. I mean, to me now as an adult, I look it back and I go, did she give up her happiness? Like, that was one thing I thought. And she came from the war during the wartime. And so that was something that I look at back and I go, obviously that's something that she doesn't see in everybody. And I was a very happy, carefree child because my parents let me be who I was. They let me be who I was and be creative and express myself. They didn't try to make me something that I wasn't. And that was where the happiness was. So that is not to say that everything was easy, and I worked very hard, and as you can tell, like, I mean, I still work very hard to this day, but at least it's in the thing I love. So happiness is, honestly, I'm going to tell you right now, it's not the amount of money you have, and it's not even necessarily in your relationships with others. If you can get a relationship with others, if you find happiness with yourself, guess what? You will find a relationship. It's just that simple. You have to, because people want to be with you because you have a good energy. And if you have a bad energy, what it means is you're pushing away someone else and you're not ready for a relationship. You're actually putting out the message that it's too overwhelming. So you gotta call it. It's real. If you can find happiness in what you do. I don't mean perfection. I mean, like, you accept yourself and you know, if somebody says they don't like you, you're like, well, you know what? That's your opinion. Good for you. But I'm letting that energy go around me. This is me, right? You know, just, you know, I'm the little, what do you call it? The train, the little something that could, like, you.
The little engine that could.
And could, yeah, you just keep going, right? Those little stories when we were kids are so valuable, but you got to find the right story. Don't do Rumpelstiltskin. So stay away from that one. You have to be, part of that is being kind to yourself, be connected to your emotions, have respect for your emotions as well as your intellect. Because if you ignore your emotions, then you are going to act out. You're gonna drink or drugs or something. You have to, because we are all emotional beings, and some people have even more emotion than others. They let it go. And you know what? That's a gift. That's beautiful. But if you have a lot of emotion, don't go over to somebody who can't handle it and expect them to handle it. You got to find the person who can handle your big emotion. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, I think you all got, everybody knows that thing where you have a lot of emotion and then some people go, oh my God, here they come again. It's drama. No. And no, you're not the problem. You just have to find the person who gets you. So that's like the internet. It's like, find the right person for you. Why, you know, you date, like, internet dating, it's like, you don't need everybody. You just need one person who gets you. So, and everything will flow from that, and you'll be happier because you can be free and you're being appreciated for who you are. So I could go on and on, but anyway, you get it, right?
I like that. Yeah. I like that a lot.
Yes, I do bring my happiness. I carry my happiness with me, and it's real, and it's not put on or fake. It's sincere, and it's, and it is, and then I try to bring good energy to other people. So Yeah, so I have done that, but it wasn't, I think it was just, I look for solutions and not solutions to problems and not looking for the problems, because anyone can look for problems, but can you find the solution? And if you have that head, you'll open up the door for good energy to come back to you, which is phenomenal. And I even told my husband this years ago. I said, you know, you have got to, you know, don't anticipate the negativity of life, you know, just allow it. It's 50-50. You don't know. Something great could happen the next minute or not. And when he started thinking this way, everything started opening up. And he came to me and he went, I cannot believe that this, you know, this works. And it sounds like a magical thing, but the truth is that it's the magic of life. You know, it's the magic of life.
I can't think of a much better note to end on than that. I want to thank you once again, Diane, for spending some time with us. And I will hold you to coming on my show, View from the Back Row. I'll have my people, which is me, contact your people. and we'll work that out. But I do want to wish you the best in your continuing career. And remember, folks, when you're programming your spooky viewing this month, Amityville Murders is on Hulu, Sling, and Stars. I highly encourage you to give it a look. And also, the Front Row Network is smack in the middle of our Halloween extravaganza called Monster Cast. For details, check out the Front Row Network on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Also, look for us under programs at nprillinois.org. Until next time, I'll see you in the front row.